Chapter 3. In fact, Petronius kept his promise. He slept all the day following his visit to Chrysothemis, it is true, but in the evening he gave command to bear him to the Palatine, where he had a confidential conversation with Nero. In consequence of this, on the third day a centurion, at the head of some tens of Praetorian soldiers, appeared before the house of Plautius. The period was uncertain and terrible. Messengers of this kind were more frequently heralds of death. So when the centurion struck the hammer at Aulus's door, and when the guard of the atrium announced that there were soldiers in the anteroom, terror rose through the whole house. The family surrounded the old general at once, for no one doubted that danger hung over him above all. Pomponia, embracing his neck with her arms, clung to him with all her strength, and her blue lips moved quickly while uttering some whispered phrase. Lygia, with a face pale as linen, kissed his hand. Little Aulus clung to his toga. From the corridor, from chambers in the lower story intended for servant women and attendants, from the bath, from the arches of lower dwellings, from the whole house, crowds of slaves began to hurry out, and the cries of "You, you, me miserum!" were heard. The women broke into great weeping. Some scratched their cheeks, or covered their heads with kerchiefs. Only the old general himself, accustomed for years to look death straight in the eye, remained calm, and his short eagle face became as rigid as if chiseled from stone. After a while, when he had silenced the uproar, and commanded the attendants to disappear, he said, "Let me go, Pomponia. If my end has come, we shall have time to take leave." And he pushed her aside gently, but she said, "Ah, grant thy fate and mine to be one, O Aulus." Then, failing on her knees, she began to pray with that force which fear for some dear one alone can give. Aulus passed out to the atrium, where the centurion was waiting for him. It was old Caius Asta, his former subordinate and companion in British wars. "I greet thee, general," said he. I bring a command, and the greeting of Caesar. Here are the tablets and the signet to show that I come in his name. I am thankful to Caesar for the greeting, and I shall obey the command," answered Aulus. "Be welcome, Asta, and say what command thou hast brought." "Aulus Plautius," began Asta, "Caesar has learned that in thy house is dwelling the daughter of the king of the Lygians, whom that king during the life of the divine Claudius gave into the hands of the Romans as a pledge that the boundaries of the empire would never be violated by the Lygians. The divine Nero is grateful to thee, O general, because thou hast given her hospitality in thy house for so many years. But, not wishing to burden thee longer, and considering also that the maiden as a hostage should be under the guardianship of Cerser and the Senate, he commands thee to give her into my hands." Aulus was too much a soldier and too much a veteran to permit himself regret in view of an order, or vain words, or complaint. A slight wrinkle of sudden anger and pain, however, appeared on his forehead. Before that frown legions in Britain had trembled on the time, and even at that moment fear was evident on the face of Asta. But in view of the order, Aulus Plautius felt defenseless. He looked for some time at the tablets and the signet, then raising his eyes to the old centurion, he said calmly, "Eight, Asta, in the atrium till the hostage is delivered to thee." After these words he passed to the other end of the house, to the hall called Cecus, where Pomponia Gracina, Lygia, and little Aulus were waiting for him in fear and alarm. "Death threatens no one, nor banishment to distant islands," said he. "Still Caesar's messenger is a herald of misfortune. It is a question of thee, Lygia."
"Of Lygia?"
exclaimed Pomponia, with astonishment. "Yes," answered Aulus. And turning to the maiden, he began, "Colon Lygia, thou wert reared in our house as our own child. I and Pomponia love thee as our daughter. But know this, that thou art not our daughter. Thou art a hostage, given by thy people to Rome, and guardianship over thee belongs to Caesar. Now Caesar takes thee from our house." The general spoke calmly, but with a certain strange, unusual voice. Lydia listened to his words, blinking, as if not understanding what the question was. Pomponia's cheeks became pallid. In the doors leading from the corridor to the caecus, terrified faces of slaves began to show themselves a second time. "The will of Caesar must be accomplished," said Aulus. "Aulus!" exclaimed Pomponia, embracing the maiden with her arms, as if wishing to defend her, "it would be better for her to die." Lydia, nestling up to her breast, repeated, "Mother, mother," unable in her sobbing to find other words. On Aulus's face anger and pain were reflected again. If I were alone in the world," said he, gloomily, "I would not surrender her alive, and my relatives might give offerings this day to Jupiter Liberator. But I have not the right to kill thee and our child, who may live to happier times. I will go to Caesar this day, and implore him to change his command. Whether he will hear me, I know not. Meanwhile, farewell, Lydia, and know that I and Pomponia ever bless the day in which thou didst take thy seat at our hearth." Thus speaking, he placed his hand on her head. But though he strove to preserve his calmness, when Lydia turned to him eyes filled with tears, and seizing his hand pressed it to her lips, his voice was filled with deep fatherly sorrow. "Farewell, our joy, and the light of our eyes," said he. And he went to the atrium quickly, so as not to let himself be conquered by emotion unworthy of a Roman and a general. Meanwhile Pomponia, whenas he had conducted Lydia to the cubiculum, began to comfort, console, and encourage her, uttering words meanwhile which sounded strangely in that house, where near them in an adjoining chamber the lararium remained yet, and where the hearth was on which Aulus Plautius, faithful to ancient usage, made offerings to the household divinities. Now the hour of trial had come. On a time Virginius had pierced the bosom of his own daughter, to save her from the hands of Appius. Still earlier Lucretia had redeemed her shame with her life. The house of Caesar is a den of infamy, of evil, of crime. But we, Lydia, know why we have not the right to raise hands on ourselves. Yes. The law under which we both live is another, a greater, a holier, but it gives permission to defend oneself from evil and shame even should it happen to pay for that defense with life and torment. Whoso goes forth pure from the dwelling of corruption has the greater merit thereby. The earth is that dwelling, but fortunately life is one twinkle of the eye, and resurrection is only from the grave. Beyond that not Nero, but mercy bears rule, and there instead of pain is delight, there instead of tears is rejoicing. Next she began to speak of herself. Yes, she was calm, but in her breast there was no lack of painful wounds. For example, Aulus was a cataract on her eye, the fountain of light had not flowed to him yet. Neither was it permitted her to rear her son in truth. When she thought, therefore, that it might be thus to the end of her life, and that for them a moment of separation might come which would be 100 times more grievous and terrible than that temporary one over which they were both suffering then, she could not so much as understand how she might be happy even in heaven without them. And as he had wept many nights through already, she had passed many nights in prayer, imploring grace and mercy. But she offered her suffering to God, and waited and trusted. And now, when a new blow struck her, when the tyrant's command took from her a dear one, the one whom Aulus had called the light of their eyes, she trusted yet, believing that there was a power greater than Nero's, and a mercy mightier than his anger. And she pressed the maiden's head to her bosom still more firmly. Lydia dropped to her knees after a while, and, covering her eyes in the folds of Pomponia's peplus, she remained thus a long time in silence, but when she stood up again, some calmness was evident on her face. "I grieve for thee, mother, and for father and for my brother, but I know that resistance is useless, and would destroy all of us. I promise thee that in the house of Caesar I will never forget thy words." Once more she threw her arms around Pomponia's neck. Then both went out to the caecus, and she took farewell of little Aulus, of the old Greek their teacher, of the dressing maid who had been her nurse, and of all the slaves. One of these, a tall and broad-shouldered Lydian, called Ursus in the house, who with other servants had in his time gone with Lydia's mother and her to the camp of the Romans, fell now at her feet, and then bent down to the knees of Pomponia, saying, Domina, permit me to go with my lady, to serve her, and watch over her in the house of Caesar. Thou art not our servant, but Lydia's, answered Pomponia. But if they admit thee through Caesar's doors, in what way wilt thou be able to watch over her? I know not, Domina. I know only that iron breaks in my hands just as wood does. When Aulus, who came up at that moment, had heard what the question was, not only did he not oppose the wishes of Ursus, but he declared that he had not even the right to detain him. They were sending away Lydia as a hostage whom Caesar had claimed, and they were obliged in the same way to send her retinue, which passed with her to the control of Caesar. Here he whispered to Pomponia that under the form of an escort she could add as many slaves as she thought proper, for the centurion could not refuse to receive them. There was a certain comfort for Lydia in this. Pomponia also was glad that she could surround her with servants of her own choice. Therefore, besides Ursus, she appointed to her the old Tyre woman, two maidens from Cyprus well skilled in hairdressing, and two German maidens for the bath. Her choice fell exclusively on adherents of the new faith. Ursus, too, had professed it for a number of years. Pomponia could count on the faithfulness of those servants, and at the same time, consoled herself with the thought that soon grains of truth would be in Caesar's house. She wrote a few words also, committing care over Lydia to Nero's freedwoman, Act. Pomponia had not seen her, it is true, at meetings of confessors of the new faith, but as he had heard from them that Act had never refused them a service, and that she read the letters of Paul of Tarsus eagerly. It was known to her also that the young freedwoman lived in melancholy, that she was a person different from all other women of Nero's house, and that in general she was the good spirit of the palace. Hasta engaged to deliver the letter himself to Act. Considering it natural that the daughter of a king should have a retinue of her own servants, he did not raise the least difficulty in taking them to the palace, but wondered rather that there should be so few. He begged haste, however, fearing lest he might be suspected of want of zeal in carrying out orders. The moment of parting came. The eyes of Pomponia and Lydia were filled with fresh tears. Aulus placed his hand on her head again, and after a while the soldiers, followed by the cry of little Aulus, who in defense of his sister, threatened the centurion with his small fists, conducted Lydia to Caesar's house. The old general gave command to prepare his litter at once, meanwhile, shutting himself up with Pomponia in the Pinacotheca adjoining the Cecus, he said to her, Listen to me, Pomponia. I will go to Caesar, though I judge that my visit will be useless, and though Seneca's word means nothing with Nero now, I will go also to Seneca. Today Sophonius, Tigellinus, Petronius, or Vatinius has more influence. As to Caesar, perhaps he has never even heard of the Lydian people, and if he has demanded the delivery of Lydia, the hostage, he has done so because someone persuaded him to it. It is easy to guess who could do that. She raised her eyes to him quickly. Is it Petronius? It is. A moment of silence followed. Then the general continued, E what it is to admit over the threshold any of those people without conscience or honor. Cursed be the moment in which Vinicius entered our house, for he brought Petronius. Woe to Lydia, since those men are not seeking a hostage, but a concubine. And his speech became more hissing than usual, because of helpless rage, and of sorrow for his adopted daughter. He struggled with himself some time, and only his clenched fists showed how severe was the struggle within him. I have revered the gods so far, said he, but at this moment I think that not they are over the world, but one mad, malicious monster named Nero. Aulus, said Pomponia. And Nero is only a handful of rotten dust before God. But Aulus began to walk with long steps over the mosaic of the Pinacotheca. In his life there had been great deeds, but no great misfortunes. Hence he was unused to them. The old soldier had grown more attached to Lydia than he himself had been aware of, and now he could not be reconciled to the thought that he had lost her. Besides, he felt humiliated. A hand was weighing on him which he despised, and at the same time he felt that before its power his power was as nothing. But when at last he stifled in himself the anger which disturbed his thoughts, he said, "Judge that Petronius has not taken her from us for Caesar, since he would not offend Poppan. Therefore he took her either for himself or Vinicius. Today I will discover this." And after a while the litter bore him in the direction of the Palatine. Pomponia, when left alone, went to little Aulus, who did not cease crying for his sister, or threatening Caesar. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.